Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I am Michael Robert Kaditz, and listeners, I'm sure you will be excited to know that I have three wonderful co-hosts today and a very interesting topic. So I will let each of our co-hosts tell us something about themselves, and then we will begin. So how about Hale? Tell me something about yourself, what university you're affiliated with, and what you're studying.
Thanks, Michael. My name is Hale Rothery. I'm a fourth-year philosophy student at Vancouver Island University, and my main focuses have been existentialism and phenomenology, and I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
Thanks, Hale. And Mark?
Hi. So my name is Mark Giles. I'm a third-year Simon Fraser University student. And yeah, I'm very interested in existentialism and metaphysics.
Yeah. Great. Thank you, Mark. And before I introduce you to Nicole, I'll say that I am Michael Robert Kaditz. I am an alumnus of Vancouver Island University. And if you've been listening to the show, you know who I am. So I will now introduce you to Nicole, who was the one that chose today's topic. So Nicole, who are you and what are we going to be talking about today?
Yeah, thank you so much, Michael, for inviting me on this this radio show and podcast. I'm really excited to be a part of it. I am a student at Simon Fraser University. I am in my third year, going into fourth year in the next semester, and I'm studying a double major in psychology and philosophy. I hope to do an honors year in psychology, and I'm thinking about going into some sort of career that conjoins psychology and philosophy. I started my studies at Douglas College. I did my Associate of Arts in Psychology and Philosophy there, and I also started in nursing, and I did nursing courses for a year and a half, and I really did enjoy learning about human biology and physiology, but my passion is truly in philosophy and psychology. So I'm here, and I really do, regarding topics in philosophy, I really enjoy existentialism like everybody else here, which is amazing. And I also really enjoy ethics, specifically bioethics, and also in relation to disability and old age and other things like that. So I'm just really excited to be here. And the topic today that I helped create with all of these lovely people here is related to science and society and the philosophy of science. And I actually took a class on science and society when I was at Douglas College, and it's inspired by this class. So today we will be talking about the demarcation question, which is a topic in the philosophy of science that is in regard to the difference between what we call science and what we call pseudoscience. And the first half of our show today will be discussing, what is the difference between science and pseudoscience? And the second half will be discussing, okay, are there any implications to allowing pseudoscience to be a part of our society? Should we actively try to stop pseudoscience from taking a hold of our society and the ethics surrounding that? So I think it'll be a really interesting conversation. And again, thank you for having me here.
Oh, well, thank you for being here, and thanks to all of you. This is going to be very exciting because I've always been interested in the philosophy of science. And I have a lot of strong feelings about science versus pseudoscience, and I'm going to try and leave my strong feelings out and keep it academic. So, Nicole, how do we start? What's the first thing we look for when we try and make a distinction between science and pseudoscience?
Okay. I would say that the first thing that we want to define what we call what science is. And of course, science can be defined, I think, in different ways. But the way I would define science is, a set of practices that follow the scientific method, which does include things also like compiling data, testing hypotheses, retesting hypotheses and doing experiments and trying to do things over and over again until you can really say that, okay, this is something that happens in our natural world. And pseudoscience would be something that does not follow the scientific method, at least as closely. But we will be talking about examples of what we do call in society a pseudoscience. And there's some examples of what we think are pseudosciences that actually do follow some components of the scientific method. So mm-hmm. that will be also an interesting distinction that mm-hmm. we bring up.
But you're presupposing that it matters that we find truth, that it matters that we find out about what the world's actually like. And so I'm going to suggest that we shouldn't presuppose that, but we should say why it matters. So we need to go back to a little bit of epistemology here, I'm going to suggest, which is that there's various theories of knowledge. In other words, how do we know we have knowledge? How do we know we have knowledge? When do we have knowledge? Do we have knowledge when we discover what the world is like in itself? Or do we have knowledge when we find our beliefs useful? And those are two very different theories of knowledge. So what do you guys think about that? A correspondence theory of knowledge suggests that we have knowledge when our beliefs correspond to the way the world is in itself. Is that what we're going to agree upon here? Is that what we're looking for with science? Or are we looking for a coherence theory of knowledge, which is that, if what we believe coheres with what other people believe or the general body of beliefs, then we have knowledge. Or thirdly, is knowledge when we have useful beliefs, which would be more of a pragmatic theory of knowledge. What do you guys think?
I think that there's probably quite a bit of overlap in terms of all of those things coming together and how we actually approach knowledge. But in terms of what we would think of as most bare bones as science or scientific understanding, or science as sort of a free-floating practice that looks at and examines the world, then science is a correspondence theory based upon our forming beliefs that correspond properly to the material world, would be probably the most popular and standard definition. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's perhaps a bit simple, but I think that's what most people think about when they think about science. Now, obviously, there's different questions about whether or not that's actually how science operates in the real world. Like, do scientists just sit there and examine some subject or object and just to look at it? I mean, generally speaking, no. Even practices of science fit into some sort of motivational framework. But I think that we can kind of bracket that if we really want to and say the actual practice of science itself is just looking at the material world and finding beliefs that fit with that material world in some sort of kind of logical, positivist, kind of reductive form.
Yeah, thanks, Neil. Mm-hmm. Any other ideas about theories of knowledge?
Say that science as we know it today does follow, I would say, in the correspondence theory of knowledge, if I'm correct, which is trying to analyze or base our body of knowledge based on what we deem objective features of the world. And that is in mm-hmm. contrast with the coherence theory of knowledge and the pragmatic theory of knowledge. And the coherence theory of knowledge states that, you know, if whatever we are trying to distinguish falls within what we already know, then we can consider it knowledge. And the pragmatic theory of knowledge considers something knowledge if it's useful to us. So I would say like pseudoscience. So let's give an example of pseudoscience. And I'm not trying to attack anybody's beliefs by saying calling something pseudoscience. I'm just trying to say like what is, you know, what people generally consider pseudoscience. Let's start with something like magnetism. So it's about saying that if you use magnets in a certain way, it can shift the energies in your body to have a certain health benefit or a positive health outcome. I could be strawmanning it, but that is my understanding of it. And I would say that in that way, you know, if people believe that, you know, magnets work in a way that can help health benefits, then that would fit within the coherence theory of knowledge because it already fits within our predetermined beliefs that magnets are helpful towards health outcomes. And in regard to the pragmatic theory of knowledge, if we think that this is a more psychological understanding, but sometimes if we think that something helps us, it can have positive mental health effects that actually do affect us physiologically. So in that sense, if we believe that magnets will help our health outcomes, and you know, in a psychologically, they, you know, it affects our physiological health, then you could say that it also falls within the pragmatic theory of knowledge. However, in regard to the correspondence theory of knowledge, which is to analyze the objective features of the world, you know, by experimentation or whatever methods, it would not fit within that. So you could say that like certain types of pseudoscience fit within all the theories of knowledge except one.
I would agree. I would agree largely with that. And I think that there's a lot of reasons for why that's the case. I think that, I mean, it depends on how we want to take the discussion. I mean, to be totally honest, I am personally not super abreast on philosophy of science, but I've had a long interest in a sort of, you might want to call them the pseudoscience of the social sciences, which are conspiracy theories, right? Which kind of fall into that vein, that family. It's been a long interest for me. It's kind of a hobby. And those generally come from a place, which would be, this is kind of more of a psychological or human analysis, but they put the cart before the horse. Instead of being an attitude of looking at the world, people approach the world in a particular way, oftentimes with conspiracy theories, and I think with pseudoscience as well. We can use the example, we're all very abreast of conspiracy theories, for example, that would be like, there's a one world government, or, you know, super evil, like people controlling the world in the background, right? So we take that proposition is fundamental, is the background to everything, and then we go from there. And we see that with pseudoscience too. I mean, I think really common forms of pseudoscience, I know we've kind of looked into some stuff outside of here, but around, like, we use the term energy, right? Everything has an energy. There's an energy going on. What that energy is, what that actually means, what someone is talking about at all, is really left blank. But we kind of start with that, and then we build from there. And so in a sense, it is coherent for someone's subjective belief. So it does fit the coherence model, because someone is approaching the world with the belief and observing the world in such a way that, you know, the world is made up of energy. Right. And so then we can go and quote unquote verify that. Right. And there might even be pragmatic for the individual, especially people engaging that, there might be pragmatic reasons for going about that. But it certainly doesn't correspond, or doesn't certainly fit within the correspondence theory of formal sciences, wherein one takes the attitude of skepticism and approach to their studies and what they're looking at, right? And to sort of start with, what do we see, what do we find, and then from there, and what can we kind of shave off and knock down, and then kind of start to make propositions about what the world actually looks like. Mm-hmm. If that makes
you
any
talked
sense.
About yeah you talked about earlier about how it sort of putting the cart in front of the horse, because it doesn't really, I guess, observe the world without any like vested interest, but mm-hmm. there are like infinitely many things you can observe, right? So merely choosing one thing over another is in fact having an interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of seems to be a bit of a problem, you know, because it sort of, it puts it in the same category with pseudoscience then.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for that, Mark. I'm going to give an example of where I think correspondence really matters. So what about Galileo? So Galileo looked through his telescope and he found evidence, empirical evidence, sense evidence, right? Using the telescope as a sense extender, but nonetheless, sense perception evidence of how the solar system is arranged and how the planets orbit around the sun. And but that did not cohere at all with the accepted body of knowledge at that time. In fact, he was in big trouble for his claims that he made, but his claims were highly justified. They were justifiable as cohering to the way the world is. But he got in big trouble. So as corresponding to the way the world is. His claims did not cohere to the body of knowledge at the time. But now we know through science that he was correct. So correspondence matters.
Yeah, that's a good thing you're bringing up there, Michael. And one thing I want to ask is, at what point should we switch over the conversation to talking about the societal implications of pseudoscience? Because I do have a few things to bring up here, but if we want to continue a conversation on still talking about the distinction between science and pseudoscience, we can continue that. I just don't know how the time is going.
Yeah, let's go back to the distinction. I actually backtracked because I wanted to lay out the premise, which is why what we're presuming here is that we're looking for correspondence with the world in itself. So now that I got that straightened out, now, Nikki, why don't you start with some of the ways that we can distinguish?
Mm-hmm. So some ways that we can distinguish between science and pseudoscience definitely fall, I guess this is, more in a traditional sense, of using science as a guide, right? But if we think of science as, following the scientific method, with experimentation, hypothesis testing, and other things like, finding how to deal with errors, compiling data and all other things that have to do with science, pseudoscience should be the opposite of that if we're going with that premise that, science is, following the scientific method. However, I did want to bring up this example of there's an article by Lewis Thomas that's called On Alchemy, and he actually brings up a really good point about how alchemy, which is, if you're not familiar with alchemy, is regarding the transmutation or transformation of base metals. So anything like, copper or aluminum into gold. So their idea is to try to find a way to turn other types of metals into gold. And that's also within that, they're also trying to look into how to cure illnesses and trying to look for, something that is a cure for all causes. So they're looking for a panacea, a single treatment that cures all illnesses. So that's kind of what alchemy is known as. And in our understanding today, alchemy would be something that's considered a pseudoscience because we know now, you can't just change one metal into another metal and have one cure for all diseases and all illnesses. But what Lewis Thomas brought up in his article was saying that alchemy was one of the pioneers of what we know today as being science, because what people did before alchemy, what we considered scientists back then, didn't really do things in the lab, or they didn't really use like the lab to do experiments. They mostly thought about things really hard in their head, and stayed relatively individualized and solo in that way. But with alchemy, it encouraged scientists to go into the lab and start to develop what we know now as the modern scientific method. So it's interesting to consider that, something that we would write off today as being pseudoscience actually has these really important implications for the history of science and the progression of science today. Hmm. And I guess I can also bring up another point too, is that some things that we know today as being pseudoscience, like let's say biofeedback, which is the idea that slowing our breathing can influence our nervous system, thinking about how we're breathing, that actually does have some scientific basis. So if you know anything about what we call diaphragmic breathing, it's shown to improve things like anxiety, stress, pain, and there's actually a scientific basis behind that. So some things that we do consider pseudoscience do have an aspect of formal science inside of them too. So there's never going to be always like a black and white distinction between science and pseudoscience.
Thanks, Nicole. What you're saying is interesting because it actually relates to the Gettier problem, which we're going to be talking about next week. So the examples you gave may be examples of beliefs that were not justified, but as luck had it, they turned out to have some truth to them later, but they weren't justified at the time. And so we can say that perhaps pseudoscientific claims, even if they turn out to be correct, even if some of them turn out to be correct, and I would argue that probably most won't. Sometimes you get lucky, and you're talking about alchemy as an example of where there turned out to be some truth to it. But if the belief isn't justified at the time, then even if it turns out to be correct later, at the time it was not knowledge. And that's mm-hmm. that's related to the Gettier problem. So Nicole, let me give you this example. Like, I know people, I was just with a group of people a few weeks ago, a mindfulness group. And they talked mm-hmm. about how it's important to align our frequencies. Something about, you know, like frequency in my foot should be aligned with the frequency in my brain and all that. And then I'm going to feel, you know, better and have a happier life. Well, that's unlikely to ever be true because it's incoherent. A frequency is a measure of something, right? It's sort of like, it's nonsensical. It's sort of like saying, you know, I'm going to get an alignment with my kilometers. It's a frequency is a measure of electromagnetic radiation. Mm-hmm. So you can't like align with a frequency isn't a thing. So my point here is that some pseudoscientific claims don't even rise to the level of being coherent with themselves. So I guess why I'm saying this, Nicole, is I don't want to allow it to go by that people would think that, oh, well, pseudoscience is fine because so many pseudoscientific claims turn out to be true anyway. So why not just believe in pseudoscience? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great point that you brought up as well about timing with the beliefs and practices and how that changes things from being considered science and things to be considered pseudoscience as well.
Yeah, I guess my point is,
anyone wants to jump in too,
yeah, Mark.
I was just going to say, I think it kind of what both you guys are saying, sort of repeating, but there's some pseudoscientific claims that, like, kind of like what you're saying, are complete baloney. Essentially, they run on made up metaphysical premises, like in this case, frequencies, which is equivalent, I think, when those people speak to essentially vibes, right, or something like that. Some descriptor that really doesn't correspond to anything material. Whether it corresponds to something social, that's kind of a different question. But then there's also, like, when you guys were talking about alchemy, it made me think a lot about a pseudoscience that had a really big influence on history, which was eugenics, right? And obviously eugenics run kind of, in a sense, you can kind of think of those sorts of pseudosciences, alchemy or eugenics, you know, that was a very, very, very popular and mainstream scientific theory in school for a long time, largely because coincidentally, it ran along real scientific theories. It sort of built itself up alongside and in a sense corresponded to actual evolutionary biology. So for a lot of people, it seemed to make sense. Now we know now that it's, you know, largely not true. But I think that there's almost two types of pseudoscience, those that sort of are parasitic on actual scientific theories and those which are essentially extrapolations from made up metaphysical premises of one kind or another.
To sort of add to that, I feel like it's a very, like, how would you say, individual thing on what you should believe or should not believe. Like, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I have a couple of my friends who like believe in astrology, right, and like talk about the star signs and so on, and I feel like on one hand, right, you know, maybe in some way they don't really believe it to be true, but in another, it like sort of, it's a fun thing to do, right? And it sort of helps them, and I guess, and stuff. This sort of relates to like, in where exactly does it like sort of become what do you believe and what sort of you like choose to follow to help you? And I don't think there's like a clear distinction between those, because I feel like for a lot of pseudosciences, it's more of a thing of it sort of helps them in like this pragmatic theory of truth. But if you look at it, the whole point of science is for it to be pragmatic, right? People don't want to know for the sake of, I guess, just knowing. They want it for some other pragmatic purpose to help society. So it's sort of, it's as though they had the same goal, right?
I would add in there that, like, you know, there are, I think, scientists themselves. There could be a good majority of them, or good amount of them, I would say, the number of them that would want to, you know, do science because they want to know more about things, regardless of its, you know, societal implications. But I think what you're saying still has some truth in there, because, yeah, you know, in order for their science to be funded, you know, it has to be funded by, you know, the university, and there has to be some sort of, you know, benefit seen there, you know, in their funding for the research, right? Like, of course, I think there could be some research that, you know, might be considered arbitrary that might still be funded, but the vast majority of research is funded by either, like, an organization that, you know, believes in, you know, something that exists because they think that, you know, their cause is important for society, or this, you know, university thinks that their research would be good for society. Mm. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of people who want to, you know, do research because they want to know more, but again, like, society in a way does restrict that, right, with the amount of funding that they get.
Yeah, I think it should definitely also be noted that it's sort of a dangerous path, right? Because it can definitely lead to a lot of undesirable pseudosciences, like Hale said earlier, with eugenics and all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks.
I think what we're getting at, what we're pointing to is, and I don't necessarily think there's any harm in this, and this is extremely widespread, like you guys are saying, whether it be things like tarot card reading or certain kinds of astrology or crystals or whatever it might be, that a lot of pseudoscience shows itself as sort of self-expression for individuals rather than fundamental commitments to beliefs about the way the world is.
Good point.
And in a sense, those self-expressions tend to be more, I mean, obviously they have a public element, but their impact tends to be more pragmatic and more private in many ways. Whereas those fundamental commitments to the way the world is are, I think, more lead towards those pseudosciences like eugenics, and like those that are more parasitic on the actual scientific process, where they masquerade as real grounds for reality.
Yeah. So I think maybe it's important that we sort of define what science is before we talk about what is pseudoscience and what is not science, right? Like, you can say how you do science, right, through the scientific method or verification and falsifiability, or you can talk about like whether it's pragmatic or just observational, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can jump in here, or unless Michael, you want to go.
No, I just wanted to say that, we have not been very successful in clearly delineating the first half of the show to be how do we distinguish between science and pseudoscience, and the second half of the show to be why it matters. And maybe that's fine. It seems to all kind of, you know, mix together. So that's fine. But I do want to touch on a couple of the fundamental ways we can distinguish. So why don't you start with that, Nikki, and then I might have one or two also.
Sure. I can say that, you know, like, the best method of distinguishing between science and pseudoscience is that pseudoscience is a type of, you know, way of doing something that masquerades, definitely, as, you know, like what Hale was saying, that masquerades as being scientific. And that is like what, you know, is considered a large danger of pseudoscience, because then people who don't have a lot of, let's say, scientific literacy are not able to tell the difference between what is actually scientific and based in fact or truth, or however you want to characterize it, and pseudoscience, which is masquerading as science using maybe fancy, you know, big words, fancy terms. But people who don't have, like, scientific literacy have a hard time distinguishing between what is actually, I guess, you can't say things proven in science, but you can say, you know, what is shown in evidence and what is not shown in evidence. And that's the issue here. I do want to go on to talk about the implications, and I have, like, a thing that I do want to say about that, but if you guys don't want to go move on to that yet. We
can. Before you do, Nicole, let me read a short paragraph from Scientific American article. I think this is a very important point. according to Karl Popper, a very prominent philosopher, the fundamental way of distinguishing science from pseudoscience, it goes like this. The big difference Popper identifies between science and pseudoscience is a difference in attitude. While a pseudoscience is set up to look for evidence that supports its claims, Popper says, a science is set up to challenge its claims and look for evidence that might prove it false. In other words, pseudoscience seeks confirmations and science seeks falsifications. What do you think?
I think that's reasonable. Yes, that's a reasonable way of also distinguishing that, because the scientific method is always looking for falsifications in itself. So I think that is that does correlate with that definition.
But having said that, and this is true to philosophical inquiry, is there's counterexamples. So if scientific claims need to be falsifiable, then what about this? What about the claim that intelligent life surely exists in the universe away from Earth? So aside from Earth, there definitely are other planets in the universe with intelligent life. So Mike, I'm going to say that that's not falsifiable. Because you can't discover every planet and falsify the claim that there is intelligent life there.
So what I would say is that could be considered both scientific and unscientific. Unscientific in the way that's not falsifiable, and it could be considered scientific in the way that if you can model through statistics that there is a high probability of there being other life on the planet, you can say then that there is therefore high probability of there being life on another planet, but you can't say it with 100% certainty.
Well, you can't say anything with 100% certainty, except perhaps an analytic statement. Yeah.
But you can. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm going to take a different approach and say that it is. So if we make the scientific claim, Michael the scientist says there is life on other planets, whatever that might be. The difference between that and a pseudoscientific claim, like, we have energy, that there's energy fields rotating between us or whatever it might be, right? Or crystal energy, is logically speaking, practically speaking, can we go to every single planet and verify whether or not there's life there? No. But logically speaking, it's not an impossibility. It would seem so far from the knowledge that we have where the material world works, that there is nowhere that we can seek out crystal energy. It's just not a thing for us to even begin with. So while we can't complete the task of verifying the claim that there are no, that there's life on other planets, we can at least try. And that's kind of, I think that's the beginning point of real science, is that we can actively try and seek it out, where pseudoscience, you're just kind of left with like whatever, when you get down.
Yeah. So I get your point, Hale. Very good. So what you're saying is that the falsibility requirement might entail logical possibility. So if it's logically possible to discover every planet and determine whether there's life there or not, then the claim is that there's intelligent life out there is falsifiable. Even though as a practical matter, we're not going to be able to do it, it is in theory logically possible. Whereas some pseudoscientific claims aren't even logically possible to falsify, either because they're incoherent, internally inconsistent, or because it just, there's category errors and that kind of thing. So like,
if you were to ask someone like, let's study ghosts, right? Where do you begin?
Right.
Like, where does that research even start?
A haunted house.
What about the claim that some people make that
you even find like any evidence for any hypothesis, really? You could walk into the house and suddenly a chilly wind would blow, or you'd see something out the corner of your eye, right? And if you look for something, you'll find it.
Yeah, but you can reduce those phenomena to other explanations other than ghosts.
How about the claim
you can do that with falsifiable theories as well. Like if I said perhaps that, you know, the acceleration due to gravity of an object is dependent on its mass, right? Which it's not. If I drop a hammer and a feather in a vacuum, it will fall, right? But, you know, it's never falsifiable either, right? Because there's infinitely many assumptions you have to test with that, right? So like maybe the time of day, you know, affects acceleration due to gravity or the light level or anything really. So I feel like it's also not really reducible either way.
People make the claim that cells, human cells, contain within them memories of our past traumas. I believe that's pseudoscientific, and I'm thinking that's a non-falsifiable claim. How could you ever prove that that information is not in a cell, right?
Yeah.
So I think in that case, the falsifiability requirement does hold up there.
I mean, in the classic example, and this is no claim one way or the other. This is God. But God is the classic example of a non-falsifiable claim. That's not this. Maybe God is real. Maybe he's not. But there's no test. There's no independent, objective, public test that we can do
to prove that there is no God, right?
Yeah. I think the thing,
one way or the other,
though, is that falsifiability comes in many different levels, right? So there's things like God, which is maybe completely unfalsifiable. And then pseudoscience, which is maybe a bit more falsifiable, but not really. And then science, which is perhaps very falsifiable. But you can never reach like 100% certainty in falsifiability.
No. But that's why I think we're talking about different types of pseudoscience, right? Like there are some that are essentially unfalsifiable, like Michael was just saying with trauma, with cells holding trauma. You know, which is a more and more common and popular belief, even in circles that seem legitimate. But then there are ones that, again, there are pseudosciences that masquerade as being more scientific, right? Like eugenics and other ones like that. That are more the falsifiability because they lend themselves more to being a real science, quote unquote. They also lend themselves to being more falsifiable. And over time, things like eugenics and alchemy have thoroughly been proven to be false.
Yeah. And before we move on.
We hold on. Go on. Sorry.
Yeah. Before we move on to talking more about the why it matters and what the consequences are, I just wanted to point out a couple more fundamental distinctions, and that's just the process. It's the quality of the study, right? It's the quality of the research. So in philosophy of science, we learn about, the distinction between a good quality study and a poor quality study. So if you're studying like groups of people to get attitudes or to look for, say, evidence of efficacy of pharmaceuticals and so on, there's all kinds of requirements, right? So for it to be a good study that produces good science, you need to have a representative sample, you need to try and eliminate the biases. And so sometimes pseudoscience arises out of poorly conducted studies or no studies at all, right? Just anecdotal information not based on a study. So it's, you know, really common, you know, like I just happen to know that when I drink this herbal supplement, and I know it makes me feel better, and my friends all say the same thing. So the error there is obvious. There hasn't been quality research done, and if someone did set up a study, then there's all kinds of requirements for it to be quality. And for it to be likely to produce good science, you'd have to have a representative sample, and you have to oftentimes have a blind or a double blind study. And so there's placebos, and people don't know whether they're being given the placebo, because sometimes people just feel better because of the placebo effect. And that's fine. I mean, if you want to have a feel better, that's great if you feel better, but it wasn't because of the efficacy of the thing. It was just because you thought it was going to do some good, so it did some good.
And maybe we should explain like the terms. Like a placebo effect is like when, like let's, okay, so in a research study, what happens is there's an experimental group and a treatment group. And, or like you could, or sorry, experimental group and a control group. So the experimental group is the treatment group. So people are randomly assigned by, you know, like a random process to either group. And what happens is in the control group, those people who are randomly assigned to that group do not receive any sort of treatment. They receive a placebo. And a placebo is like, let's say that, you know, for example, we want to test a drug, right? Those people in the control group would receive a sugar pill. So they would be taking that sugar pill every single day, but and they would be thinking that they're taking the drug, but they're actually not getting the effect of that drug. Whereas in the experimental group slash treatment group, the people are receiving the actual drug. So the placebo effect is where in the control group, the people are thinking that, you know, since they're receiving that drug, they must be getting better because of the drug, but they, but for another psychological reason, you know, they do feel better, maybe because, you know, they feel like they're getting attention or they feel like they're being cared for or other things that actually does, it, those effects go on to improve their physiological well-being and psychological well-being. So I just want to explain that just in case maybe some of the listeners don't have the background on that. Yeah, I hope that helps.
Great, Nicole. Yeah, and I'm ready to move into why this all matters. And I just have two quick points and I'll let you guys take it away. So one is okay. When I drive over a bridge, I want that bridge to be built upon science, to have a foundation, pun intended, right? A foundation of science. I want this the belief system that goes into the building that bridge, the blueprints and the engineering to be based on a correspondence theory of knowledge, right? I want the science to be based to correspond to the way the world actually is, to the best of our knowledge. I don't want that bridge to fall down, right? I don't want people to build a bridge because, you know, they because it coheres to the way bridges were built, you know, in the past. I want the latest technology, the latest science to come into play. So that's an example of where I think the correspondence theory of knowledge matters. Another way that I think it matters is the authoritarian playbook, right? So when we look at politically and political philosophy, we look at the different types of political systems, and authoritarian leaders often are able to gain power by getting people to subscribe to pragmatic theories of knowledge, right? So the authoritarian leaders develop their alternative realities. We see that happening to some extent now to a great extent with Trump in the United States, where the authoritarian leaders purposefully convince or prime their followers to follow alternative realities. So that's a form of pragmatism, right? So it's no longer correspondence to the world, but rather it's what works. In this case, what works for the authoritarian leader. So, I mean, you actually have in the United States now, Trump can get his followers to believe that what he said 2 days ago and is on video, he didn't actually say. So that's my second example of where science matters, like the truth matters, correspondence matters. So yeah, take it away, you guys. How else, what does it matter, or if it matters? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, Michael, what you're touching on is that there are danger issues. Like you can have possible risks to your well-being and to yourself by, you know, like driving over a bridge that is not based on science, right? There are existential threats to you. There could be, you know, based on, you know, not by having pseudoscience as an accepted form of inquiry. And then the second part that you touched on is also with political, you know, implications, right? What I would like to talk about as well is kind of how accepting pseudoscience into our knowledge and into, you know, and as an acceptable inquiry of knowledge affects the way that we think and how that way of thinking affects society. So this could even be possibly generalized to, you know, thinking in with, you know, coherence or pragmatic theory of knowledge over using correspondence theory of knowledge. Because what I want to say, you know, like, okay, so if we are saying that, you know, it is okay, you know, to have, you know, pseudoscientific beliefs, even, you know, as, you know, Hale said, you know, within yourself as your identity, you know, as a private thing, you know, you could have that as a private thing and have it, and in that way, you'll be following either a coherence theory of knowledge or a pragmatic theory of knowledge. With the coherence theory of knowledge, in that way, you'll be thinking that, okay, this pseudoscientific belief or this belief in general, regardless of if you recognize it as pseudoscience or not, is acceptable because it, you know, it correlates or coheres, you know, with all of my previous beliefs. That is the coherence theory of knowledge. The pragmatic theory of knowledge is saying, okay, since this works for me, it is okay, right? So either in that way, then pseudoscience can follow within those theory of knowledge. What I want to say again, I just want to go over that in case, you know, because it's even I like sometimes can be confused with the definitions, but I do want to say, what is the student our society? Is encouraging a coherence or pragmatic theory of knowledge bad for society? And in this way, I want to say that, you know, thinking in this way is somewhat or entirely an infringement on encouraging critical thinking in a society. And in this way, what I mean by critical thinking is the ability to use, and I think that, you know, science is fundamental to critical, like a fundamental component of being able to think critically, but that is to be able to think of knowledge, you know, through a, like, let's say, like a quote unquote objective set of, you know, values. You're trying to eliminate all or most of your own personal biases when you're evaluating knowledge. You're trying to, you know, evaluate knowledge on its merits and not, you know, use logical fallacies like ad hominems, you know, or other things when you're evaluating that knowledge, right? So I mean, maybe somebody else can give a better definition of critical thinking in itself, but I want to say that I think that if we make excuses or justifications for pseudoscience being allowed or acceptable, even in a private level, it is encouraging people to throw away or not develop their critical thinking skills. And in this way, we need critical thinking skills in a society to be able to function in optimal or the best way that we can. And critical thinking skills influence our democracy, our politics, you know, things like voting, things like understanding the issues that people are doing, understanding when people are using fallacies or unethical ways of coercing us and persuading us to believe a certain things. It's being able to look at the knowledge for itself and being able to take away any other, you know, forms of, you know, I guess, sophistry and, you know, misleading, you know, aspects of that knowledge, right? There's also, it can, you know, not having social critical thinking skills can also influence, you know, social issues in society and our ability to address them as well. And there's several implications, you know, that we have by not having developed critical thinking skills as a population. And I think that by saying that, you know, pseudoscience is okay, even on a private level, that's encouraging people to not develop their critical thinking skills. And you guys can go on from there.
Yeah, I think definitely with like, I feel like in the end, it very much comes down to like, if it's pragmatic or not. Yeah, both with critical thinking and going over top of a bridge, right? You know, when you go over top of a bridge, right, I don't think it's that you want it to have been built in a way that coheres with, I guess, the way the world is. Or, you know, it's more so that you want to get over to the other side, not fall to your death, right?
And what I could say, too, based on that is like that, you know, the correspondence theory of knowledge, the one that we say is scientific, that is trying to analyze the objective features, you know, quote unquote, objective features of our society, can also correlate with being a pragmatic theory of knowledge. So you can say that, you know, yes, like not all correspondence theory of knowledge will be pragmatic, but they're not mutually exclusive in that sense. So what we could say, you know, like, there's a difference between, you know, saying like, okay, I just want to be able to drive across this bridge, right? And you can, like, in that way, you know, you can put your gas on the pedal and try to go as fast as you can, so you're not like putting the weight on the bridge with your car, right? That could be like, in a sense, a pragmatic theory of knowledge. But the better way would, by having that, is by combining that with the correspondence theory of knowledge, that's based on also analyzing the facts behind what is going on and if that correlates with, you know, our scientific knowledge or reasonable knowledge. Mm-hmm. Right.
No, I think the thing is, it definitely becomes very impragmatic if you just don't use a coherence theory, right? You know, sooner or later a bridge is gonna, I guess, break.
Or the correspondence theory, I think, just to confirm that, because the coherence, coherence theory of knowledge is saying that accepting a piece of knowledge into your worldview because it correlates or coheres with your other views, like, because it aligns with those views and it's not too different from those views.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm just trying to think about this. You know, I think at its base level, like, the most fundamental sciences are all, I think, generally correspondent, right? So, like, you know, math, physics, biology, and then we can kind of move up the chain into the human sciences and things like that. And each one of those sciences, as it moves on in the sequence, becomes, as Aristotle would kind of say, we have to be more and more liberal with our accuracy, right? So math is obviously productive. It's 100%. It's 100% accurate. And as we move up the chain, we get less and less. So, and then from, but like pure physics, is not creative. I think pure physics is a process of discovering through the scientific methods that we've already talked about. But it's from pure physics that we get things like architecture and city planning and, you know, whatever that might be, that we then have useful and coherent projects that fit into our live world. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, we don't, you know, someone who's just studying physics, what do you do with that?
I mean, I have to say that definitely in quantum physics, it gets very interpretive and creative. There's numerous different interpretations.
Yeah, thanks for that, Mark. But Hale, I wanted disagree with you, and I'll give you an example. If I'm standing out on a dark night in a field looking at a amazing sky with stars, and and I can see I can see the Andromeda galaxy, right, several, you know, million light years away, I'm in awe. So the pure science of it, right, the pure physics, the pure astronomy, right, pure science, I think, can be very awe-inspiring.
But that's not what you're talking about. Isn't the practice of science, right? The practice of pure science is going out there and just studying the beings as they are in themselves, right? And trying to break them down and know them more and more clearly, right? Obviously, we can be awe-inspired by science. The point of this, though, is that I think, is pseudoscience dangerous, and should we like let it go? I mean, no, but I also think we have to be realistic in the fact that it's kind of built into, I almost want to say it's built in the logic of language, that the way people understand and interpret their world and the way that we speak about things is eventually going to lead people to understand themselves in ways that don't correspond very well to reality, and that it's just going to happen sometimes, and that we really have to be careful of, instead of going after things that are, perhaps more personal, even though, again, there's issues with that. The reality is that the more dangerous forms of pseudoscience are those that really try to masquerade as science itself, as public studies of beings in themselves.
So,
Maybe you can go.
I just want to say quickly,
go ahead. Sure.
No, mine's really quick. Hale, you're taking a very pragmatic approach. That's very pragmatic of you. Go ahead, Nikki.
I would say, like, in reply to that, Hale, I don't know if I like agree with you 100% on that, because I think, you know, on the other hand, you know, like, you were touched on social sciences as being maybe like less scientific in the sense of, compared to, you know, like more of the hard sciences, you know, physics, math, chemistry, right? I would say in that sense, though, like, I don't think things need to be a perfect science, you know, in order to be acceptable, right? But I think that if they are following some sort of, way of following the scientific method, I think that that is definitely better than, you know, succumbing to a non-scientific way of reasoning. I want to clarify here that, you know, in the social sciences, they do still use the scientific method and hypothesis testing when they are trying to come up with their hypotheses and their theories and their research. This still is, you know, very largely so following the scientific method. And what I would say here is, you know, there is always going to be that conflict, you know, with people maybe even naturally going towards, like what you suggested, Hale, naturally falling towards, you know, this pseudoscientific way of believing or way of understanding themselves. But I think that critical thinking is something that's really important to emphasize here, because, you know, I think the directionality in this doesn't really matter too much. But, you know, either if we teach and we implement critical thinking skills early in life and throughout life, you know, it might be able to prevent people from having pseudoscientific beliefs. Or, you know, like, we could also try to, like, put a damper on pseudoscience and at the same time encourage people to think more critically. Because I think, again, like what I was bringing up before, that allowing people even personally to have these pseudoscientific beliefs does conflict with critical thinking, because critical thinking involves being able to use the scientific method and evaluate information on its merits without, you know, as much bias as possible.
I feel like I'm sort of maybe sympathetic in some way to pseudoscience, or maybe more so asympathetic towards science as being
okay,
as rigorous as it claims to be, I guess.
Yeah, that came out. That came out today.
I definitely do, I guess, believe that taking up like pragmatic approach definitely leads to very pragmatic consequences.
Sure, you're forgiving of pseudoscience. What about you, Hill? What's your verdict?
I have a very high opinion of the hard sciences, and I think that I think the correspondence theory of knowledge is really the way to go. I really don't have a high opinion of pseudosciences in general. Especially those that try to masquerade as members or subparts of the hard sciences. But I am also, like you said, kind of pragmatic and realistic, that I think there's an element, there's a characteristic of pseudosciences that I think is much more ingrained in people's self-understandings and worldly interpretations. And is something that's probably not as easy to work out and push through that as we think, and perhaps is maybe not as damaging as we think. I think that
great.
To some degree, I land with Mark on that one.
Okay.
To a certain degree, although I would definitely not call myself a pseudoscience fan by and large.
Right. Thank you very much, Hale. And thank you, Mark. And thank you, Nicole, for the topic. And I'm Michael Robert Kaditz. And thanks to our listeners. This has been the Canadian Philosophy Show.